Okay. Good morning, everyone. A pleasure to be able to learn with you again on this fine Sunday morning. The topic that we'll be exploring today is a topic that in some ways isn't new or unique to COVID. It really has, you know, much broader application, but something that became a lot more prominent during COVID. Though, as I remarked before the recording began, it actually isn't a topic that I've seen widely discussed in the past several months, even though it probably was very practical for those for whom it was applicable. That topic is the topic of making havdalah when you can't smell. Not losing your sense of smell or having a drastically altered sense of smell is one of the sort of more prominent symptoms of COVID-19. And in addition, it's one that's most noticeable. It was different from, let's say, the flu, for example. It really sticks out as a distinct kind of symptom. It's one that, you know, in theory, I can imagine being not as severe as some of the other symptoms of COVID, which are more likely to run into territory surrounding pikuach nefesh and what kinds of things you could do on Shabbos in order to maintain or preserve health or life. Losing a sense of smell doesn't seem to fall into that sort of high stakes kind of category. But nevertheless, it has, you know, at least one halachic ramification with regard to brachot based on things that one smells, which of course we make during Havdalah. So our plan for today is to explore some of the background of saying besamim, saying bereimei besamim and smelling besamim during Havdalah in general, and then discerning whether that is sort of fully obligatory or whether that's not the case, and what impact that might have on whether one can say the bracha when one can't smell. I'll just mention that, you know, these discussions aren't themselves novel. Like I said at the beginning, people have, you know, lost their senses of smell for various reasons in the past. My mother, for example, is fond of telling me about a friend of hers who, for some reason, lost her sense of smell, and I think most of her taste also, to the point where one of the only things she could taste was mustard, and so she would buy a lot of mustard and put mustard on most of her food just for the sensation. So that's one, you know, kind of person who may have some either neurological or physiological feature that would prevent them from smelling properly. Perhaps more commonly, it's just someone with a very bad cold or flu when one's nose is clogged and one can't smell, or one can't smell well enough to be able to smell besamim. And that also would be a situation where this discussion would be relevant. So it doesn't seem that COVID uniquely brings this issue to the table, as opposed to some other issues that are more unique to the coronavirus pandemic. For example, any issue regarding minyan, those issues are relatively novel and relatively unique, because for the most part, we haven't been put in a position where we, let's say, can't gather a minyan together for a wedding, for example. So this issue is a little bit more sort of like well-trodden in traditional halacha pre-COVID, but does have unique application for many people with symptoms during COVID. With those words of preamble, let's get started on some of the sources. As always, I'll be sharing my screen. Before we even get to the source sheet, it's just worth pointing out as a reminder, and this will be useful for context as we keep going, that the bracha of borei minei besamim actually exists independent of Havdalah. It's not a unique bracha that we say only during Havdalah and no other time. It's actually a subset of a much larger discussion about brachot that we say on smells in general, right? The same way we make brachot on food that we eat, we also make brachot on smells that we smell. You're seeing, for those of you watching a video now, you're seeing a page from Halachapedia, just a go-to reference source for some of these kinds of things. And it just outlines the brachot that we would say on many kinds of nice-smelling things, on shrubs and on tree products, synthetic smells, natural smells, oils. So the huge, you know, range of brachot on smells, and learning the halachot of which brachot are appropriate for which smells is sort of a similar kind of difficulty to learning what brachot are appropriate on which foods. It's just more common that we'll make brachot on foods that we eat than on smells that we smell. For some reason, making brachot on smells in general seems to be something that's somewhat neglected in some of our communities. It's just less, you know, prominent to be studied and practiced. But in principle, in halacha, there are brachot to make on smells in general. And fundamentally, that's what Brei Menehi V'Semen is. It's a bracha on a nice smelling thing. We're smelling, you know, in my household, we use cloves, people use cinnamon or other nice smelling oils. And you make the bracha of Brei Menehi V'Semen as part of smelling that thing during Kabbalah. So bearing in mind that fundamentally it is a bracha on the smell sort of independent of the mitzvah of Havdalah is something that's going to be important as we examine the significance and status of Brei Menehi V'Semen in the course of Havdalah. But now to our sources. So this first source that I'm aware of for this idea of saying Brei Menehi V'Semen during Havdalah is a Mishnah, Masechet Brachot. This Mishnah starts off, Elu hadvrim shebein Beit Shammai uvein Beit Hillel basuda. This is a bunch of machlokot between the school of Beit Shammai and the school of Beit Hillel about various kinds of halachot surrounding Shabbos and meals. These things seem to go together. And the Mishnah says Seuda, but many of the issues end up being Shabbos-related kinds of issues. And so skipping to our relevant line, Beit Shammai Omerim Ner Umazon B'Samim V'Havdalah. This is the order in which one makes relevant brachot when it seems one's meal actually goes until after Shabbos. So your meal is over, you need to bench, you need to say Birkat Hamazon, and you also need to make Havdalah. And so what you do is you make the bracha on the Ner, the candle, right? I guess Borei Morei Ha'esh. Then Mazon, you know, Birkat Hamazon. Then B'Samim, Borei Menehi V'Semen. And then Havdalah, Hamavdil Ben Kodesh L'Chol Ben Orla Choshech, etc., etc. That's Beit Shammai's order. And Beit Hillel has the same order, except he switches B'Samim and Mazon. So he says, Ner, then B'Samim, then he, you know, includes benching, and then Havdalah. Interestingly enough, I don't see this practiced generally as well, that we would sort of intersperse benching into our Havdalah. The way it will often work is, even if a meal goes after Shabbos, people would typically bench, daven Marav, and then make Havdalah afterwards. But the way it's presented in the Mishnah, it seems like those would almost be integrated. The Mishnah just goes on to make, you know, a few other comments about when, about the kinds of candles and the summon that one is allowed to use for the purposes of Havdalah, but we won't go into that right now. So just to note that there is such an obligation of, I shouldn't say obligation. There is a practice of saying Borei Menehi V'Semen that is interspersed among the other brachot associated with the end of Shabbos and Havdalah. A couple of explanations seem to be offered in Rishonim for why we smell B'Samim and then make the appropriate bracha on the B'Samim as part of Havdalah. So a couple of them appear in this passage in Tosfot. They're asking the question, V'im Tomar, Lamna Nimne'u Kishachal Yom Tov V'Motzei Shabbos Milahariach B'Samim. Why do we not say Borei Menehi V'Semen when you have a Shabbos followed by a Yom Tov? When you have Shabbos followed by Yom Tov, what we'll do is we'll typically incorporate into the Kiddush of Yom Tov the bracha of Havdalah, but we won't do Borei Menehi V'Semen. Mitchell wants to know why that is the case. He suggests a couple of, in so doing, rather, he articulates a couple of potential explanations for why one would say Borei Menehi V'Semen in general, and then try to figure out whether those should be applicable when the next day is Yom Tov. So the first thing he suggests is, Ga'am ein shayach l'farushei taima mishum eish gehenom shematchil lisrof ulhasriach. We should not say that the reason we don't say Borei Menehi V'Semen on a Motzei Shabbos that is also a Yom Tov is because the reason for saying Borei Menehi V'Semen in general is to counteract the bad smells of the fires of Gehenna, the fires of hell. Don't say that Mishum Eish Gehenna Shemetchil Yisrofu L'Asriach. The idea that Chazal presents is that the fires of Gehenna stop burning for Shabbos and they sort of begin again on Motzei Shabbos. And there's a negative sort of putrid smell that comes from those. And so smelling B'Samim is a way of sort of spiritually counteracting that negative smell. And that's the reason that we would say Borei Menehi V'Semen and smell B'Samim on a regular Motzei Shabbos. But kishachal yom tov b'motei Shabbos, as ein ha'ish manchil lisroch u'lasriach, u'lekaf lo mavarchinan. So we might say, okay, if Moti Shabbos is also a Yom Tov, then the Eish Gehenim is not going to begin burning again. And therefore, there's no need to say Bereyamin of the Samim. Tosfo rejects this answer. He says, well, okay, if that were true, then after Yom Tov, we would say Bereyamin of the Samim as part of our Havdalah then. And we don't do so. After Yom Tov, Havdalah does not include the Samim. So he rejects that reason, that explanation for Bereyamin of the Samim and smelling the Samim as part of Havdalah. Then he suggests a second explanation, which might be more familiar, and also ends up being the explanation he prefers. V'gam ein lefarish, dehada mevarchinan abesamim v'motzei Shabbos, mishum nefesh yetera sha'avad. The reason that he's proposing at this point for why we might say Bereyamin of the Samim on Motzei Shabbos as part of Havdalah is because of the nefesh yetera, or the neshama yetera, that we possess on Shabbos. There's this notion that we have an extra soul or some extra element of our soul on Shabbos. And that extra element is lost when Shabbos ends. Just giving to Gemara and Beitza that articulates this more fully. Amar Shimon ben Lakish, Neshama Yetera Noten HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ba'adam Be'erev Shabbos. God gives an extra neshama to a person on Erev Shabbos. U'lemotzei Shabbos Notun Notah Himenu. And it gets taken from him on Motzei Shabbos. So during Shabbos, we have this extra neshama. And he justifies it with the drasha, but that's unnecessary for us for now. So based on this idea, Tosfos says, look, when you lose the neshama, you're going to be, you know, upset. And so what you do is you smell basamim, and the pleasant smell of basamim will sort of calm your mind and make it easier to transition back into a week when one does not have that extra neshama yatera. So he suggests maybe that should be the explanation for why we don't say it when Yom Tov is after Shabbos, because on Yom Tov, you preserve your Neshama Yetera. The Yom Tov, it lay Neshama Yetera as well, and is only removed after Yom Tov. Tosfos rejects this explanation as well, because he believes that if that were the case, then after Yom Tov, we would say Bereyamin B'Samim as well, because we would again have lost our Neshama Yetera at that point. So either explanation he gave doesn't quite address why Yom Tov is different from Shabbos in terms of Havdalah, either because of the, you know, Eish Gehenim kind of presentation, or because of the Neshama Yetera version. But Tosfos' conclusion, which is relevant for us, explains as follows. The Yesh Lomar, de la olam ta'ama de mevarchinan abesamim v'motzei Shabbos, have a mishum Neshama Yetera. He really thinks that the true reason we say Bereyamin abesamim on Motzei Shabbos is because we lose our Neshama Yetera on Motzei Shabbos. Uve Yom Tov leka Neshama Yetera. And on Yom Tov, we don't actually have this extra soul, this extra Neshama, as part of our makeup on Yom Tov. Shabbos and Yom Tov seem to be different in this regard, according to Tosfot. And that's why we say Bereyamin B'Samim after Shabbos and not after Yom Tov. Now, this hasn't answered Tosfot's primary question, which is, why don't we say it on a Motzei Shabbos that is also a Yom Tov? But he explains at the end, when you have, you know, a really nice Yom Tov meal with, you know, great food, you don't really need the besamim to sort of settle your soul at that point, because the good food of a Yom Tov meal should be sufficient for that purpose. I've never heard of a suggestion that says that when you don't have besamim, that one thing you should do on Motzei Shabbos is have a very significant meal. But based on this Tosfot, that might be a justifiable kind of position. Because if you're missing Besamim, but you still want to sort of console yourself for the missing Neshama that you possessed on Shabbos that you no longer do, then having an extra meal seems to serve that purpose, according to Tosfot's explanation. I'll note that at least one point of support for Tosfot, that one has this extra Neshama Yetera on Shabbos and not on Yom Tov, is from the Gemara that we had seen before, which says that God gives us a Neshama Yetera on Erev Shabbos and removes it on Motzei Shabbos, but makes no claim about Yom Tov. So it seems like it might only be applicable for Shabbos and not for Yom Tov. So far we've seen Tosfot's two sort of proposed explanations for why we would need the Samim as part of our Havdalah, either because of the sort of putrid odor of the Eish Gehenim that we wish to counteract, or I guess perhaps more optimistically, this idea of consoling ourselves for our Neshama Yetera that we possess on Shabbos and lose during the week. Rambam's presentation is similar, but I think slightly different, and it's worth just picking up on the difference. Rambam says, "V'lama mevarchim al habesamim b'motzei Shabbat, mipnei shehanefesh do evet liyitziat Shabbat." Because one's, you know, spirit is pained by Shabbos, you know, departing from us because Shabbos ended. So we sort of uplift our spirits with a besamim. Rambam doesn't appeal to this notion of a neshama yetera and whatever like spiritual connotations that might have. Rather, he sort of defers to the experience of just leaving Shabbos and entering the work week, and that being something that we need consolation over. So it's fundamentally a pretty similar presentation. I guess you might call Rambam a little bit more psychological and Tosfot a little bit more sort of spiritually oriented. But the same sort of basic principle of self-consolation is at play. Okay, so far we've seen the origin or the first reference to Besamim as part of Havdalah, and then a couple of explanations along the same basic theme for why we need to use Besamim as part of our Havdalah. We're going to next look at the question of whether one is sort of obligated to smell Besamim as part of Havdalah or not. But before we do, I'll pause for any thoughts or observations. And for a drink as well. Okay. So let's continue. The follow-up question to, hey, we smell Besamim for this reason is, well, do we have to or can we choose not to? Bearing in mind that, you know, fundamentally, it seems that the purpose of Besamim is to console ourselves and make ourselves feel better. What if I say, I don't really need that. I'm okay being a little bit uncomfortable because Shabbos ends and we're back to the work week. Do I need to continue saying Havdalah? Or do I need to continue saying Besamim as part of my Havdalah? So this happens to be a dispute in the Rishonim. The Gemara, on which the Rishonim engage in this debate, makes the claim that if you don't have a candle for Havdalah, you're not obligated to sort of run around trying to find a candle for that purpose. Even though for other mitzvot, let's say, if you don't have Arba Minim on Sukkos, you know, Lulav and Etrog, you would be obligated to go find one in order to fulfill the mitzvah of taking the Arba Minim on Sukkot. But for Havdalah, that is not the case, according to the Gemara. And that's the Gemara that the Rush begins by saying. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, in Machzirin al Ha'or. We don't need to, maybe Machazirin al Ha'or. We don't need to sort of, you know, chase a fire if we don't have one. Lefisha Brachazo explains the Rush. Eina ela lezecher ba'alma. It's not obligatory. It's just a reminder that shenivra ha'or b'motzei Shabbos, that light, or fire rather, was created on Motzei Shabbos. And not actually a bracha on the hana'a of the or. The imishum hana'a or, if it's about the hana'a that you get from looking at a fire, and it was a birkat hane'enin, much like eating food requires a bracha, smelling nice things requires a bracha, so maybe looking at nice fires also requires a bracha. The Rosh says that can't be, because if that were the case, then every time you looked at a fire or benefit from a fire, you would need to make a bracha, and that is not our practice. And that's what we know, that it's not a bracha on the hana, it's just a bracha as a sort of reminder of the creation of a fire on Motzei Shabbos. And then the Rosh concludes or infers from this, Mikol Shekein al HaBesamim, all the more so if this is true by Besamim, that you don't need to go around trying to find Besamim if you don't have any, De'eina ela l'hashavat nafsho, because the purpose of Besamim is only to sort of make oneself feel better, is to settle one's soul, one's nefesh. And therefore, if one doesn't have them, it's certainly not an essential part of the mitzvah. And if maybe even the Rush might go so far as to say, if one doesn't need them, one might not have to use them. It's potential that the Rush would say that. He doesn't articulate that explicitly, but his logic might lead to that conclusion, that really just because it would uplift you. And if it doesn't uplift you or you don't need that uplifting, maybe it wouldn't be obligatory. The flip side or the opposite position is taken by the Meiri, who says, Mikol Makom, in contrast to the Nair, the fire, where you do not have to, you know, trace down a fire if you don't have one, Al HaBesamim Mechazrin, you do have to try to find Besamim, Shelechvod Shabbat Hutkenu, they were established for the honor of Shabbos. Lehodat Neshama Yetera. I guess to inform the Neshama Yetera, or to inform you about the Neshama Yetera. It's a little unclear to me what he's referring to in this section. But I think more primary are the first three words here. They were established, the Chavod Shabbat. So first of all, he uses the word established. It's a takana. It is sort of formally imposed as an obligation. And so one must use Besamim as part of their Havdalah, according to the Meiri. And the purpose of the Havdalah of the Besamim is not for our own sort of being uplifted, but it's for Kvod Shabbos. It's to acknowledge the significance of Shabbos, right? Noting, for example, that when Shabbos leaves, the Neshama Yetera left, and being so distraught when Shabbos leaves actually shows kavod for the Shabbos that we just experienced. Right? Shabbos is so important to us that when it leaves, we need to be consoled because it really is so so challenging to lose Shabbos. It reminds me a little bit of the Midrash that Rashi quotes about Shemini Atzeret, this idea that we have the Sukkot, and then after the holiday of Sukkot, with all of the associated korbanot and simcha, God says, "Kasha alai preiratchem." I'm so distraught when you leave me. So God has this sort of extra holiday just for Bnei Israel to have an extra one more day before we have to leave. So this idea of wanting to prevent the departure of something or being distraught when something departs seems to correlate to giving honor to the thing itself. I think it's actually a very interesting kind of claim by the Meiri. And that justifies for him the idea that Bereimim B'Tzamim is actually obligatory. So we have this dispute between the Rush on the one hand and the Meiri on the other hand, with the conclusion of that machloket being in the Shulchan Aruch, who says, Mevaret ala B'Tzamim im yeshlo. If you have B'Tzamim, you should make a bracha on them. V'im enlo, ein tzarach lachzor achareihem. If you do not have them, then you don't need to try to track them down, which is in accordance with the position of the Rush and against the position of the Meiri. Now, it's typical practice that one generally does say Bereimim B'Tzamim as part of their Havdalah. And certainly, there were Rishonim who thought it was obligatory. So there is the advantage of fulfilling all positions. But if you don't have B'Tzamim, the baseline halacha is that you don't need to trace them down and try to find them for Havdalah. You should just make Havdalah without them. Okay, so now just recapping everything. After introducing Besamim, we've seen a machloket about whether it's obligatory and have concluded that it's actually not. So that lowers the stakes on our question by a great deal, because if the idea is that Besamim are not obligatory, so worst case scenario, person who can't smell can't do this not obligatory thing called smelling Besamim as Mochi Shabbos as part of Havdalah. Worst things have happened. The stakes are now at this point relatively low. Nonetheless, it's appropriate to know what the right practice is, and we'll continue with that in our next section. But it's worth noting that at this point, the issue is pretty, pretty small in terms of its severity. Okay, but what do we do when a person can't smell? What is the practical guidance? So we can start with the Shulchan Aruch. I actually will start with the Shulchan Aruch here, who says, Mi she'eino me'riach, eino mevarech al ha'besamim. If a person cannot smell, then he does not make the bracha on Besamim, with two exceptions. One of the exceptions is universally agreed upon, and one of the exceptions is subject to dispute, and we'll see that shortly. Ela im kein nitkave lahotzi b'nei beito haktanim she'igio l'chinuch. Unless you're trying to fulfill the obligation for one's underage children, who are obligated in chinuch, or vis-a-vis whom he is obligated in chinuch. What I mean by that is that there's a general principle that applies to many mitzvot, where children who reach a certain age and a certain degree of intellectual maturity, one is actually obligated to instruct those kids in mitzvot, and to encourage them to reform mitzvot and help them fulfill what would be their obligations were they adults. One manifestation of that halacha is that one can make a bracha for a child as part of the educational process in fulfilling his mitzvot, especially if he or she doesn't know how to make bracha for themselves. When we have students in preschool or in kindergarten and are doing bracha as part of their education, so this is an important halacha to bear in mind, that it seems that one would be able to say a bracha, you know, normally as part of the education process, so that children will learn the correct way to say a bracha, even if one oneself isn't, let's say, eating. So if, you know, everyone in the classroom is having, you know, a juice box for snack, and the teacher is not doing so, it might still be appropriate to say the bracha properly for the kids as part of their educational process. That's the halacha that, as far as I can tell, is not in dispute. The halacha that is a little bit more controversial, that we'll see shortly, O lehotzi mi she'eino yodea. According to the Shulchan Aruch, one can say Borei Minei Besamim, even if one cannot smell and cannot thereby benefit from the Besamim that one is smelling, in order to fulfill the obligation for one who doesn't know how to say the bracha of Borei Minei Besamim. This is based on a general principle that we'll see, you know, just one quick iteration of in the next couple of sources, called Kol Yisrael Arivim Zeh LaZeh, or Arivut, this idea that all Jews are mutually responsible for one another. This is a principle that has a wide number of applications in halacha. One of those applications is our application, that a person is able to make a bracha on behalf of someone else, because when you haven't fulfilled your obligation in a certain mitzvah or in a certain bracha, you're not the only one responsible for that. I am also responsible for fulfilling that obligation or helping you fulfill that obligation. And therefore, if you haven't made a bracha yet, I have an obligation to make that bracha as part of helping you fulfill that obligation. And so I'm allowed to make a bracha, even though usually we would not encourage a person to make an extra bracha in which one is not obligated. Just one, you know, caveat or one observation about that comes from the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and as developed by some of the later sources we'll briefly look at. Tani Ahava Bereda Rabbi Zera. Kol HaBrachut Kulan Ahava Pisha Yatza Motzi. With regard to any bracha, even if I've already fulfilled my obligation personally, I've already said Borei Minei Besamim, I no longer have an obligation to make that bracha. Borei Minei Besamim might be a bad example, so let me choose something else. I've already said Kiddush. So I've already fulfilled that obligation. Nonetheless, I can make Kiddush on behalf of someone else, based on this principle of Arivut, of Kol Yisrael Arivim Zeh LaZeh. The exception is Chutz Mibrachat HaLechem Mibrachat HaYayin, which seems to be a proxy, though it's not totally clear this is the case, but it seems to be a proxy for Brachot Hana'anin, Brachot based around Hana'ah, She'im lo yatza motzi, v'im yatza eino motzi, where if I have not fulfilled the bracha, let's say on lechem, so I eat, if I have not eaten bread, I'm about to eat bread, I can make hamotzi, and other people can listen to my bracha, say amen, and then have fulfilled their obligation in that manner. But if I'm not eating bread, I can't make the bracha of hamotzi on your behalf. And the way that gets articulated in the Mishnah Brura, who explains the idea behind this, is that with regard to mitzvot, kasher chaver lo yatza yedei ha-mitzvah, when you haven't fulfilled your mitzvah, have a ke'ilu hu lo yatza. It's as though I have not fulfilled my obligation either, because your obligation remains unfulfilled, and I'm obligated in your obligations. Mishumachi yachol ha-otzi afilu hu kvar yatza yedei ha-mitzvah. That's true for bracha ha-mitzvah. That is not true by brachot based around hana'a, brachot on food, let's say. Even though a person who's eating food is obligated in making a bracha, it's a proper obligation, and one who fails to do so violates, you know, whatever level of prohibition it is that's articulated here. It is usher to benefit from the world, from the physical world, without making a bracha. There's a prohibition involved in not doing so, and one's obligated to make a bracha. Mikol makom biyado shelo lehenot velo levarich. It's not an absolute obligation in the same way that mitzvot are absolute obligations. And as much as if I choose to not eat now, I would no longer be obligated. And so we can't make the argument that if I haven't made a bracha on a food, it's as though you are obligated to making the bracha on the food, because it might be that I decide not to eat the food. So that sort of transference principle of my obligation to make a bracha to you doesn't seem to apply to brachot hana'anin, to brachot based on hana'a. Levichach oto she'eno nehane ein nekra mechuyev v'bracha zeh. The person who is not obligated in the bracha, who's not eating, also doesn't have this sort of transferred obligation of arivut to make sure that I make a bracha, because even I am not really so obligated in making a bracha on food, because I could choose not to eat food at this moment and then not have that obligation. based on this principle, what we have to determine is when one makes a bracha on besamim, which category is it more like? Is it more like making a bracha on a mitzvah, in which case the Shulchan Aruch's presentation would be accurate, and I can make a bracha even if I've already fulfilled my mitzvah, or on the flip side, if I am not able to fulfill the mitzvah at this point because I can't smell. Or if the bracha besamim is closer to being a bracha hanen, a bracha based on hana'a, in which case that seems like it would not be the case. Right? Bearing in mind what we saw before, and this is where the introduction comes back to us, that the bracha of Berei Minei Besamim is fundamentally a bracha about hana'a. It exists independent of the context of Havdalah, and we only say it in Havdalah because we're getting some hana'a during Havdalah, the hana'a of the good smell of whatever it is that we're smelling. And so if we think of it more as a bracha hanenin, then this halacha on the Shulchan Aruch would become more difficult to understand. So in looking at this question, we could first go back to what we've seen before, the machloka between the Rush and the Meiri. The Rush thinks that saying Berei Minei Besamim isn't obligatory, and one need not, you know, go out of one's way to find Besamim in order to say it, because it's just for, you know, personal kind of benefit. Whereas the Meiri had thought it's obligatory. L'chvod Shabbat hutkenu. It was established for the purposes of honoring Shabbat. And it's possible that that machloka would also impact the subsequent halacha, that if Berei Minei Besamim is an obligation during Havdalah, then one would be able to be motzi others in that bracha. And if it were not, then one would not need to do so. There's another, I guess, more explicit articulation of this machloka, which seems to revolve around similar axes, but with some slight differences. So in dealing explicitly with the question of can one fulfill the obligation for someone else when one, let's say, can't smell, we see explicit sources quoted in the Torah. If one cannot smell b'samim, have a bracha levatala if one is mevarech al b'samim. You can't make a bracha when you can't experience the thing that you're making the bracha on. You also can't even make the bracha in order to fulfill the obligations of other people. The lo dami lekiddush va'adalta ubrekat hamotzi shal mitzvah. These other brachot, kiddush, abdallah, hamotzi, where you can fulfill the obligation for others, even if you are not yourself obligated in so doing. Well, you could do that because shehin chova, because they're themselves obligatory, they're mitzvot. Aval zeh eino ela minhag ba'alma. This isn't an obligation. This is only a minhag. It's fundamentally one of the brachot hanenin, a bracha based on hana, and not really a formal obligation. And so one would not be able to do so according to Rabbeinu Ephraim. And that fits everything that we've seen before, which was the idea that when it's not an obligation and one could choose not to do so, then one wouldn't be able to fulfill the obligation on behalf of someone else if you yourself are not someone who needs to fulfill this obligation. This is a position that is objected to both by the Tur himself and by the Beit Yosef for different reasons, it seems. The Beit Yosef takes the more obvious tack, and he says, Esher l'kaim horat harash, the aval gav de'eno chova, even though it's not an obligation, kevan shechachamim kavu oto minhag, havelei mitzvah. Once the chachamim establish this minhag as something that we do, then it becomes like a mitzvah. Even if it's not formally a mitzvah, in the same sense that the Meiri had argued that it really is formally a mitzvah or a fulfillment of Kvod Shabbat. Nonetheless, because it's an established minhag, it's like a mitzvah, and one is sort of quasi-obligated in so doing. And therefore, another person can fulfill that quasi-obligation even if they themselves are not in the parsha of being obligated themselves. The Torah argues for a different reason. The Torah seems to reject our earlier claim that one cannot fulfill a bracha for someone else in brachot hana'anin, in brachot based on hana'a and not based on mitzvot. The reason I alluded to a footnote here is because when we see Rav Rimon's presentation, I have to zoom in. I didn't realize how zoomed out this would be. There we go. This is the one footnote in the entire presentation here where he notes this observation about the tour. Trying to track it down here. Yeah, there we go. He has a footnote himself, and he alludes to this point that I just made, that really the Torah objects for a different reason than Beit Yosef. I happen to appreciate this just because it reflects this, on the one hand, awareness of presenting a full halachic picture, which is something that's important for a posik to do, but at the same time, to not bog down every reader with all of these almost parenthetical kinds of details. And so he puts the information there for one who wants it. It's in a footnote. It's available. And it's not hidden, but it's also not sort of essential to the argument he's making. That's why we're not going to spend more time on it. But I just wanted to note that as part of some of our broader, you know, process claims when we look at Postgame and how they issue their rulings, oh, we could put some information in the parenthetical comments, so to speak. That's one thing that Rabino does. And so again, so we see this machloket between Rabino Ephraim and the Beit Yosef about whether Rabino Ephraim is considered a mitzvah or not a mitzvah, and that seems to have the ramification that we expect it to have. If you think it's a mitzvah, you're likely to enable someone else to fulfill it on your behalf, even if they themselves cannot fulfill the mitzvah for themselves because they can't smell, let's say. And if you don't think it's a mitzvah, you'd be less likely to say so. And we had seen the Beit Yosef who had said that, in his opinion, l'hotzi mi she'eino yodea is a legitimate reason for someone who can't smell to say b'rei minei b'samen. I'll point to the Mishnah Berurah. We'll skip the next one for a minute. The Mishnah Berurah says that really all of the achronim. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okay, I thought I heard a question. The Mishnah Berurah says all of the achronim disagree. I don't think he means all of the achronim, but he lists an impressive list: Taz, the Magen Avraham, El Yaraba, Tosfos Shabbos, Erechayim, the Gra, like marshals, you know, a healthy number of achronim who disagree and who say that this isn't the case for the reason that we mentioned. That when one has an obligation, one is able to make the bracha for other people, even if they themselves don't have the obligation. But, and for one's children is also the case. When you have ketanim, that's certainly the case. But when it's not a mitzvah, one does not need to do so. And the Mishnah Berurah presents this as the opinion of most achronim against the position of the Shulchan Aruch. That becomes important for Rabbi Mona. We'll look at his presentation in just a moment. I will point out that the Beit Yosef quotes at least one opinion of the Or Chaim that a person should make the bracha of Berei B'nei B'samim if they can't smell, even for themselves. Sha'afo pi she'enu margish bereach hana, even though you don't get the hana of actually smelling the thing when you can't smell, nonetheless there is a benefit of smelling it. Yeshlo shemechazik. I misparsed the sentence. Hana yeshlo. There is hana for this person. Because smelling nice things really sort of fortifies you physically, even if you can't experience the smell. Nonetheless, there is a physical ramification of that. I'd be very curious to speak to medical practitioners who would be able to tell me whether that's actually the case. If a person without the ability to smell, you know, smells something anyway, does that do any good for him? I'd be curious to know what the answer is. But the Or Chaim says, if that's true, then a person could even make the bracha for themselves, and that might be one reason to allow someone who can't smell to make the bracha of Berei Minei B'Samim. So in everything we've seen so far, we've seen a pretty extensive background to this question of whether one who can't smell is able to make the bracha, if not for themselves, then for others. Rav Rimon deals with most of the same background that we've seen, so we'll just look at his conclusion. Based on the Shulchan Aruch being a minority opinion, and Rov Ahronim disagreeing with it, he concludes, Lachain, Adam Hachole Bekorona She'enu Yachol Lahariach. If a person has COVID and can't smell, Yitain LaAdam Achel Lemarein Yerkat B'Samin. Another person can, he should have another person make the bracha because he can't make the bracha for himself, and he also shouldn't really make the bracha for others, with the exception maybe if there were young children around for whom he can make the bracha, but he doesn't seem to be concerned about that possibility. Now, if a person is alone, imhu nimsa levado, yidaleg al brachat b'samim. You should skip the bracha b'samim. V'yotzei yidei chovat havdalah lemarot shelo amar klal al brachat b'samim. Because b'samim isn't an essential part of havdalah. It's an ancillary thing that we do for the reason that we mentioned at the beginning. And you still fulfill havdalah without making that bracha, and so that's what a person should do. He adds at the end here, a person should still say Borei Pri HaGafen even without being able to taste the wine, for reasons similar to the reason that the Or Chaim thought you should be able to make Borei Minei B'Samim even if you can't smell. Because even though you can't get the hana of the taste of the wine, Hare Yesh Lo Hana Mikach Shayayin Mazin Otel. The wine, you know, fortifies him and gives him, you know, nutrition. And even if you can't taste it, still that's a thing that one would make a bracha on. This last paragraph that I wish we'd have time to look at, but I think we're getting a little bit over time. I just want to look at one or two more things after this. is a really beautiful paragraph that Irving Mohn writes about, where he describes the value of the sense of smell and how the smell is a much more kind of spiritual, or yeah, I guess spiritual would be the way to call it, non-physical kind of pleasure, as opposed to food, which is much more physical. The smell has this way of really uplifting a person. He notes that when you enter a house and there's like a nice smell, you know, something cooking in the oven or a perfume or something that smells very pleasant, that it really creates a much more pleasurable environment. And he sort of acknowledges the significance of the smell and makes a point to say that since, you know, so many people are really finding this very challenging, those who are suffering from COVID and have lost their sense of smell, it's a reason to, you know, on the one hand, be sensitive to that loss. And on the other hand, to be more appreciative of the ability to smell for those who have had it and have not been so afflicted. It's a really beautiful paragraph. And actually, one thing Rabbi Mohn does is that many of his tshuvot end with a paragraph like this. After dealing with the halacha and issuing his psikat halacha, his final conclusion, he then adds, you know, a nice couple of paragraphs, sentences of encouragement or of appreciation or some framework in which to draw meaning from this halachic discussion, which is something that I actually very much appreciate as a unique feature of his presentation as opposed to some of the other poskim. Very, very briefly, we'll just look at a few of the other presentations of this issue of Havdalah when you can't smell. There are a number of svarim that came out over the past several months. They're much larger svarim as opposed to the individual rulings that we examine in our tshuva together. These are, you know, proper, like, full tomes that try to deal with as many issues as possible. One of them is called Hevyanei Chadarav, a reference to, you know, being in a cheder when one is in lockdown. So Hevyanei Chadarav brings me into your cheder, brings me into your room. And in dealing with the halacha, he almost sort of simply quotes the halacha as it appears in Shulchan Aruch, right? Misha ebed et chush hareach in a mevarech bracha hareach. You don't make the bracha on smells when you can't smell. And what about making the bracha on behalf of other people? Well, he points us to the Mishnah Berurah that we had seen, where the Shulchan Aruch rules that you can make the bracha on behalf of others, but most of the Aharonim think it's not a very good idea. Sort of relatedly, we have this journal, Asya, which is a journal of medical halacha, came out with an issue about COVID, and it tells us as follows. Echad ha-tasminim shamachlat ha-corona, one of the symptoms of corona, hu ibud chush hareach, is losing the sense of smell. And therefore, you can't really make Havdalah on Bisamim on Motzei Shabbos for that reason. But you can make the bracha for those, for Kitanim who might be in your midst. This was a comment that Rabbi Mohn did not really make and did not address as part of his final conclusion, but whoever wrote this article in this journal thought it was worth mentioning. And he quotes, you know, a pretty extensive discussion in this footnote here, footnote 143, in how developing this halacha. Most of it is summary, but I will note this last comment here. The Shu'at Halachot Ketanot says, it's not only a case when one loses one sense of smell totally. Shehu adin gam misha yishlo nazalah. It's not only when someone has lost their sense of smell totally, even if you have, I'm not sure precisely how to translate nazalat. I think it'd be something like having like a stuffed nose, meaning the kind of thing that you have when you have a cold or a flu and you can't smell, but it's temporary. And that seems to be the case for many people with a sense of smell during COVID, where you'll lose it temporarily and it will come back in some form. It has not been true for everyone, but there are many for whom it has been true. And so the halacha is also applicable, even when it's only a temporary loss of smell and not a permanent one. I just thought it was worth noting. And then he makes a comment that we really haven't seen discussed so much, but is also, you know, of practical relevance. If you can't smell the besamim, nonetheless, if someone else is making havdalah in the household, you can imagine a world where one person has corona and they're having another member of their household make havdalah for them. So they can still say amen to the bracha of Berei Menei V'Samen. The Ein Ani Aton Achshevet Hefsek, answering amen isn't considered a hefsek in the Havdalah, right? The idea being that you shouldn't interrupt within your recitation of tefillah or brachot and having a hefsek. So saying amen for this bracha that you're not yourself fulfilling because you can't fulfill it when you can't smell, nonetheless, it's not a hefsi. Kivan shehu miseder ha'avdala u'michvod ha'mitzvah. It is miseder ha'avdala. So it's not a deviation and a break from havdala to say amen. It is a fulfillment of havdala to say amen to this bracha. And it's kvod ha'mitzvah. You're honoring the mitzvah of havdala and the mitzvah of borei minei b'tamim by saying amen to it, and therefore you should feel comfortable saying so. This was also a comment that Rav Rimon did not mention in his final ruling. He just said that you should have someone else make the bracha. He doesn't say that you should make amen. Perhaps for Rav Rimon it's obvious. But I thought it is worth making explicit because one might think that saying amen to a bracha that you're not party to, and when you're saying it as part of a recitation of many brachot where you don't want to have a hefsek, you might run into the problem. But this ruling suggests that that should not be the case, and I have not seen anyone who thinks differently. Okay, so we're a little bit over time, but just very briefly to summarize, we have seen the basis for the idea of saying Borei Minei B'Tamim and smelling B'Tamim as part of Havdalah, based on this idea of sort of self-consolation when one loses either one of the Shema Yetera or just the idea of losing Shabbos in general for the week. We've seen a couple of disputes as to whether it's obligatory or whether it's just some, you know, an extra value, something that we find beneficial, maybe a minhag, or not. And then we saw the major ramification of that discussion is whether one can make the bracha on behalf of someone else. If it's a mitzvah, one can. If it's a minhag or just a bracha hanen and just a bracha we make for the purpose of hana'a, that should not be the case according to most opinions, with the potential exception of the tour per our footnote. And we saw the practical conclusion, which seems to be that one should not make the bracha for oneself, nor should one make the bracha on behalf of someone else, except with the exception of ketanim, of young children, because of the obligation of chinuch as functions a little bit differently. We also briefly looked at Ramon's presentation of his position, as well as his sort of uplifting conclusions, which I appreciate as a unique feature of his tshuva, and a few of the other practical presentations. I'm going to stop sharing and also stop the recording, but I'll stay on for other people's thoughts.